Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. To the world's elite club of Nobel Prize winners for literature, Harold Pinter, Toni Morrison, V.S. Naipaul, Octavio Paz, and more, add this name, Orhan Pamuk. The announcement from the Swedish Academy yesterday cites the Turkish novelist for his grasp of the clash and interlacing of cultures. No kidding. Only months ago, Orhan Pamuk, cosmopolitan, multicultural, straddling East and West, Islam and secularism, stood in the dock in Turkey on criminal charges of insulting the Turkish identity. At a fraught moment between Islam and the West, the Nobel Committee's choice is a bell ringer. Up next on Point, 2006, Nobel Prize for Literature winner Orhan Pamuk and the artist at the edge of East and West. Joining me now from New York is this year's winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature announced yesterday in Stockholm, Orhan Pamuk, author of The White Castle, My Name is Red, Snow, and more. 9 months ago, he was on trial on charges of insulting the Turkish identity. Today, he's crowned with the world's top honor in literature. Orhan Pamuk, welcome and congratulations, sir.
Pleased to be here, Congressman. Thank you very much.
What does it mean to you, a Turkish novelist in 2006, to win this award?
Well, first, of course, it's such a great honor, such a distinction. It's a sort of responsibility. I felt that at first, Turkish language, Turkish literature, the whole culture was celebrated. Then, of course, personally, I've been writing fiction for the last 32 years. I'm dedicated to my table, to desk, to pen, pencil. That is, in a way, was recognized. I was very happy about that. And also, since Turkey never had the Nobel Prize, there is also a national pride in it, which I'm very happy to participate. So these three things combined, and it's an overwhelming thing. In fact, I did not have much time to enjoy it, rather address all the issues, answer questions, try to give answers to all friends and readers.
Yeah. Were you in New York when you got the news? How did you get the news?
I'm teaching at Columbia University this semester. I was sleeping. The phone rang, and I thought, since I just came a week ago, I was not accustomed to New York lights. So I thought, what is this in the middle of the night? Then I answered. Then my agent told me that that in a few minutes the secretary of Swedish Academy will call me and ask me. And then right after that, the secretary of Swedish Academy had called me and asked that I have received a Nobel Prize and shall I accept it. And I said, of course, I will come to Stockholm with my daughter, after which I immediately, and then he said, now I have to announce it. And then I called my daughter.
Wow, fantastic. The Nobel Prize in Literature just yesterday for Orhan Pamuk, Turkish novelist, the first for Turkey, and a very interesting choice by the Nobel, by the Swedish Academy, the Nobel Committee there. Mr. Pamuk, if you'd stand by for just a moment, an old friend and translator of yours is with us from the University of Warwick in England. Maureen Freely joins us. She's translator of Orhan Pamuk's work, including many of his works, including Snow, The Black Book, Istanbul, and Memories, Memories and the City. I think this is the first time you've had a chance to talk since the award. Maureen Freely, welcome.
I left a message to Maureen's mobile. Hello, Maureen.
Hi, I can say it to you now. Congratulations. I'm so excited.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm so happy. I left a message to you. Did you get it?
Yes, thank
okay,
you.
I'm
and
very
my
pleased.
Answer is yes,
and
yes.
Maureen had really made me much more accessible to English-speaking readers. I am very grateful to Maureen.
Maureen Freely, what are your thoughts on this day? Here we are the day after the Nobel Prize in Literature goes to the man you've translated into English. What does it mean to you, to Turkey, to the readers?
Well, I've never been so excited in my whole life. I just can't get over it. Orhan and I have grown up in the same place. We come out of the same place. When I first read his first novel in English translation in 1990, I wasn't expecting anything at all. And then I saw this great work of art, and I said, this is the real thing. He's explaining to us the world that we live in, making it, showing it in a new light. And there's going to be more, and there was. And now I'm right.
And here it is, the most exciting day in a life. You were childhood friends. I want to bring one more voice into this old home week. Joining us from Chicago is Stephen Kinzer, former New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul, author of Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds, has interviewed and known Orhan Pamuk for a long time. Stephen Kinzer, thank you for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. What a day.
What a day. Stephen Kinzer, put this in perspective. What does it mean for this man to win this award now?
I think it's very significant, obviously, in the literary world, but it's it has to have some significance beyond that. I think the Swedish Academy sometimes tries to send broader messages that go beyond the literary. At this moment, Europe is making very clear to Turkey that it really doesn't want anything to do with Turkey, that it doesn't want Turkey in the European Union. There's a constant stream of criticism of Turkey from Europe. And I think this is disturbing some people who see Turkey as a possible bridge between cultures. They are hoping to slow this process down and make Europeans realize the importance that a modern democratic Turkey could have for the whole world. I think that's a little bit of the message that the Swedish Academy was sending. They're trying to remind people about Turkey and its coming importance in the world, as well as rewarding a very gifted writer.
Orhan Pamuk, we've only got you for a few more minutes. We want to get right to the heart of this if we can. The Academy itself lauds you for looking at a clash and interlacing of cultures in a new way, bringing new symbols to it. Here's Turkey, astride the East and West, right there between Islam and the West. What does it mean for Turkey's internal conversation with itself, where you have harsh critics in addition to supporters? What does it mean for Europe's and the West's relationship with Islam for a writer in your particular position to be recognized in this way?
Well, look, let's not generalize that much.
Okay.
I tend to think that I wrote some books, and some people, some juries, and Nobel jury liked them, and readers had liked them, and then they just gave me a prize. Yes, of course, there is always a tendency to make interpretations, to find politics, this or that. But really, I look at it in a more simple way. I'm writing stories, I'm writing books, people are reading it, and this distinguished committee and this very great prize just honored me. It may be some politics, but look, I'm not going to interpret this as East-West Turkey's. Although I have strong ideas about these issues, I don't want to mix these things together.
But the Academy itself has done some mixing here. It lauds you for discovering new symbols for the clash and interlacing of cultures.
Yes. My books are, just like Turkey, my work are a testimony to the fact that East and West do not clash. In fact, they come together. There may be confusing, anarchic moments, just as my texts are. There may be some shadowy, dark places when East and West can try to come together. My books are a testimony to the fact that even paying attention to human lives combines East and West, because Istanbul, my city, whose stories I tell, is made from both East and West. I think that paying attention to stories, human beings, little details of life, streets, chemistry of my town. These are the things I consider more important here, rather than clash civilizations. Although, yes, of course, there is a point. For example, my White Castle, my name is Red, Black Book, and my last political novel, Snow. Of course, these are about Islam modernity, but then this is our life. This is what we live.
Maureen Freely is going to read from some of your works for us, so we will not ignore the literature itself, the language itself, and it's wonderful, but still it is so striking. It was only 9 months ago you were standing on trial in a Turkish court in the suburbs of Istanbul, people screaming at you, hitting you on the head, insulting you to your face, charged with insulting the Turkish identity for talking about the killing of Armenians, the killing of Kurds. It's quite a turnaround, but will it be welcomed by, who will welcome it and who will not welcome it in Turkey?
Yeah, I think I have some conversation with friends in Turkey. It's 90% welcome. All that, I think that all that hostile energy has vanished, or at least decreased. I think the total effect of the prize in Turkey is very good, and this is also, in that sense, good for Turkish democracy and Turkey's movement to European Union. And all this trial and all these nasty things related to it, I tend to forget them, although I remind my readers that this 301 in Turkish Penal Code, unfortunately, still is efficient and is threatening writers, journalists, people who try to express their ideas.
We have only one more minute with you. It's a time of real tension and fear, concern between Europe and Islam, between the United States and Islam. What's your message today? What can you say to that?
I think clash of civilization is a fanciful academic idea, and since people begin to believe it, it's getting to be realized. Just don't be so manic. Just relax. Just pay attention the way, even if people in Islamic countries are also living like you, looking at TV, smoking their cigarettes, or that people are in the world are the same everywhere, whatever the religion is. Just don't look at it from this religious or culture and civilization point of view, but try to understand and address human beings, their stories. This is what I did in all my life.
And Stephen, Maureen, there's so much to get into here. There are a lot of politics, but there's a lot of literature as well. And Maureen, I hope you'll help us begin to get that in our ears. If you've got some readings from some of the translation you've done of Orhan Pamuk, we'd love to hear a bit. To begin to walk us in, some people will know his work very well, some not at all. Introduce us.
Well, we've been talking a lot when we say it's not just a political decision, it's about the literature, and I and other people have been talking about the great themes that he covers and the fact that he's in a place that merges East and West and so on. And I think what's gotten left out of this is that his writing is very, very playful and very, very imaginative. He has ideas only a child could have. There are lots of what-ifs. And so I've chosen two very, very different pieces that reflect that kind of thing. And the first is from the beginning of Istanbul, his memoir. So I'm just going to read a little bit from this.
And could you just place it for us? Remind us, he grew up in Istanbul, an old family there. Grandfather made a fortune, a bunch of that gone by now. So this is really home turf for the take it easy about the culture clash, Mr. Pamuk.
Yes, relax and enjoy, yes. From a very young age, I suspected there was more to my world than I could see. Somewhere in the streets of Istanbul, in a house resembling ours, there lived another Orhan, so much like me that he could pass for my twin, even my double. I can't remember where I got this idea or how it came to me. It must have emerged from a web of rumors, misunderstandings, illusions, and fears. But in one of my earliest memories, it is already clear how I've come to feel about my ghostly other. When I was 5, I was sent to live for a short time in another house. It was at the end of one of their many stormy separations that my parents arranged to meet in Paris, and it was decided that my older brother and I should remain in Istanbul, in separate places. My brother remained in the heart of the family with our grandmother in the Pamuk apartments in Nişantaşı, but I would be sent to stay with my aunt in Cihangir. Hanging on the wall in this house, where I was treated with the utmost kindness, was a picture of a small child. Every once in a while, my aunt or uncle would point at him and say, "Look, that's you." The sweet doe-eyed boy inside the small white frame did look a bit like me, it's true. He was even wearing the cap I sometimes wore. I knew I was not that boy in the picture, a kitsch representation of a cute child that someone had brought back from Europe. And yet, I kept asking myself, is this the Orhan who lives in that other house? Now, that's the brings out a lot of the themes that he plays around with in his childish adult way. This idea that there's a second world into which he can go and wander around and play games and make reality better than it is.
That's just terrific. We want to hear more, but let us just sit with that for a moment here.
Okay, sure.
Maureen Freely reading there from Orhan Pamuk's Istanbul Memories and the City, his memoir. Of course, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature yesterday. She is his translator and childhood friend. Stephen Kinzer, former New York Times Istanbul bureau chief, also with us. Stephen, your newspaper today, among others, writing about exactly what Maureen's pointing to here, the doubleness that is so often brought up in Orhan Pamuk's work. Talk about that with us, because that's not only something personal, it's also a kind of doubleness in Turkey's own national character.
That's very true. It's an influence in Orhan's writing from Sufi tradition and from some modernist traditions outside of Turkey, but he loves to play with this idea that there's more than one reality. And I think that's very much a part of Turkish life. I would even go beyond saying that there's this doppelganger idea that he plays with, which actually does come up in a number of his books. Mm-hmm. It's not just a bifurcated personality. It's not just two sides. It's a multifaceted personality. That's what Turkey is. Turkey is composed of a tremendous variety of pieces. It's a very complex and rich mosaic. And I think that same description could be used for Orhan's writing.
But when we look at that doubleness in Turkey, the first thing that draws our eye is the tension between today, between Islam and secular Ataturk Turkey, the tension between Islam and the West. Is this somehow swirling through Pamuk's writing?
It is, but I think it's swirling through it in a kind of a negative way. It's something that Orhan doesn't really approve of or believe, that there is this sharp division between what Turkey was and what Turkey must become. What his great contribution is has been to point the way towards a new, modern, vibrant Turkey and to embrace its modernity. But unlike other Turkish writers who have also done that, he has also mined the very rich vein of Ottoman and other pre-Ataturk Turkish traditions. He is saying there is no conflict between these. And what actually makes Turkey so rich is its long tradition and its history. So actually, to be modern in Turkey should not mean, as Turks have been told for many decades, that they must cut themselves off from their Islamic and Ottoman past. On the contrary, it is only by embracing the fullness of their richly varied identity that Turks can really fulfill themselves in the modern world.
But it's also interesting to notice how Orhan came to this position, because he had a very Republican childhood and then a very Western education. But the rule was don't look back, don't look back. It's retrograde. Our culture doesn't count. So
his family's rule or Turkey's rule. Don't look back at the Ottoman Empire. Don't look at what's gone. Let's look ahead.
Yeah. So anybody who read Sufi writing was considered to be sort of a blockheaded reactionary. Mm-hmm. So what happens with Orhan is that he... After leaving school, becomes a 25-hour-a-day reader and is particularly taken up by Borges. And when he's reading Borges, he finds out that Borges is interested in Sufi writing. And so he comes back to Sufi literature and Persian poetry and Arabic poetry through Borges. So this is a perfect example of how there isn't a divide. There's this wonderful river going back and forth. And allowing people to see their own culture with new eyes because they've been in another culture.
Need not be a divide, says Orhan Pamuk, but yet that's the very kind of fulcrum on which so much is turning and being debated today. We want to hear more of his work, but also to bring our listeners in. Harold's calling from Aberdeen, Idaho. Hi, Harold. You're on the air.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I would like to make a comment that I think that some of the controversy with both this author and the female author that was recently acquitted of the similar charges have to do with the fact that the world media is helping stroke these flames of, oh, look at these bad Islamics. They're against this and against that. If nobody said anything, then the stories would go away.
I wonder about that. There's an awful lot of tension right in Turkey. But Maureen, what do you say to Harold?
Well, speaking as a journalist, I think that you're right that you know, the easy stories, the templates of journalism making these false divisions come true. But I think that there are other journalists, and Stephen is the best of this breed, who at every opportunity try to convey to the thinking reader that this is not so, and that they should understand Turkey in its historical context as a former empire having become a nation and entered the modern age.
Steve Kinzer, I want to put a little reality check here on the notion that there's no real conflict. I mean, we're not here to stroke a conflict, but I mean, I'm reading in your newspaper in the last few days, you know, across Europe, Europeans worrying that maybe Islam just can't be reconciled with European values. We go to Turkey itself, and the blows to Orhan Pamuk's head in court earlier this year were no joke. I mean, we do have real tensions here, as much as Orhan Pamuk wants to see it in another way and shows us another way to look at it. Do we not?
There certainly is a tension between Europe and the idea of Islam, and that includes Turkey. And there are tensions within Turkey. But I think these tensions within Turkey can be greatly overstated. There is, and has been for a number of years, for a whole generation now in Turkey, a conflict going on between the majority of people who want to see Turkey modernize and complete its journey toward democracy, and a small, ever-reducing group of ultra-nationalists and old-style Turkish patriots who believe that this is going to eat away at the uniqueness and the strength of the Turkish race. Now, the large majority of Turks who are interested in progress and modernity are inevitably and very steadily and relentlessly winning this conflict. And this prize is going to be a great encouragement to them. Now, the blows that Orhan Pamuk suffered on the way into court and the mere fact that he was indicted are held up in the world as examples of the Turkish state's determination to crush dissent and free thinking. Actually, this isn't the case. Mm. That case against Orhan Pamuk and the case against the other writer to whom the caller referred, Elif Shafak, and a number of other cases in Turkey are being brought by a small clique of ultra-nationalist lawyers. And the very same people, the same 25 people, turn out in front of the courtroom every time there's one of these trials and try to throw tomatoes and get themselves on international television, which they succeed in doing. But that doesn't mean that they represent a broad strain in Turkish life. I believe that the modernity, as Orhan Pamuk defines it, is the real guiding principle that most Turks embrace.
Of course, that case came because of he was quoted in a Swiss newspaper magazine saying that, quote, 1 million Armenians and 30,000 Kurds had been killed in Turkey. He wrote in The New Yorker earlier, or late last year, I guess, saying that he had gone on to complain that talking about this it was taboo in Turkey. He said it's common knowledge that a large number of Ottoman Armenians were deported, allegedly for siding against the Ottoman Empire during the First World War, and many of them were slaughtered along the way. That raised an outroar, an outcry, Maureen Freely. Do you agree that it's just a tiny number of...
Yeah, I agree. It is a tiny number. Unfortunately, they have very, very powerful friends, and we don't know who what their names are, but they seem to be in very powerful places, and they seem to be able to operate with impunity in these courtrooms. And Stephen's absolutely right. These are show trials, and there are these scuffles and things that are done in front of the every single courthouse. 80 cases so far, 45 to go before the end of the year. And these ultra-nationalists use these TV appearances to make it look as if they have a lot of support and to try to sway public opinion. By the way, they're not Islamists. And from our point of view, from the West,
Turkish
it looks
nationalists,
as if
I guess.
They're Turkish nationalists. Mm-hmm. And amongst in that coalition, there are some Islamists. Everything, as we keep saying, is very complicated in Turkey.
Orhan Pamuk,
can I make one other comment?
Yes, please.
Regarding the case against Orhan, I'd like to correct something you said, because
Please.
It's a common and very simple mistake to make, I think, to say that Orhan Pamuk was brought to trial because of a one-sentence statement that he made in a Swiss newspaper.
I'm
that's
quoting him. I mean, maybe...
Quoting him, exactly. But that's not really why he was brought to trial. This group of ultranationalists in Turkey mm-hmm. is very eager to prevent Turkey from joining the European Union.
Yes.
How are they going to do that, considering the fact that most Turks want to join the EU? What they want to do is make Turkey look bad in the eyes of Europe so that Europe will become more and more anti-Turkish
and
won't accept
thank you.
Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, they're thinking, who could we prosecute? Who could we file a case against that would make the Europeans the most upset, the most angry? Who's the Turk that's the best known and best loved in Europe? So they figure, hey, maybe it's Orhan Pamuk. Now, let's get a file and go through every article that Orhan Pamuk has ever been mentioned in, and we'll pull out something and we'll prosecute him for that. It was not that somebody read one statement of his and got outraged and prosecuted him. It went the other way around. Someone decided to prosecute him, and then they looked for some statement by which to do it.
So there's a real campaign underway here, and even so, we have this remarkable back-to-back images over the space of months of a great novelist in the dock, a great novelist now garlanded by the Nobel Prize Committee. Let me get a call from John in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, everyone over there.
Hi.
Yeah, my question is, why not Turkish intellectuals as Mr. Pamuk and other writers and come forward boldly, like he does, and talk about the Western democracy is not really possible in Turkey at the moment. I mean, Mr. Pamuk, in my opinion, is so gritsy when he comes to expressing the human rights and other issues. Why not the other so-called intellectuals they come forward?
Thank you for asking this question. Mm. It's a really important question. And the answer is he is not the only one. He did open the subject of the fate of Armenians in the Anatolian Armenians in 1915 when he made his famous comment. However, he knew that there was in the planning stages at that moment a conference by Turkish scholars for Turkish scholars aiming to open up that issue in a constructive and scholarly way. That conference did happen, although certain parts of the state and the government tried very hard to shut it down, succeeded once, almost succeeded twice. This debate has come out in the public domain. The fact is that if 80 writers have been prosecuted during this year, yes, there absolutely
80,
there's a eighty, and 45 more to come.
That's a big number.
So there are, there is a strategy about using these writers as pawns, but also there's huge and very very interesting debate going on in Turkey. There are amazing writers and artists and intellectuals and scholars who are opening up taboo subjects, challenging the official line, and also doing incredibly interesting work, which rises out of the tensions that we keep discussing. They are discussing it. The real problem is those of us who know this culture and care about it, for us to convey in the Western media that it's going on, because almost always when I write about this subject, that's the part that gets edited out.
We've been joined by Maureen Freely, translator into English of The Black Book, of Istanbul Memories, and The City of Snow, a big seller abroad and in Turkey. And Stephen Kinzer, joining us from Chicago, former New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul, author of Crescent and Star Turkey, Between Two Worlds. We're joined right now from Turkey by Hale Parla, literary critic and professor of literature at Bilgi University in Istanbul. Hale Parla, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Thank you very much for joining us. How is the news of Orhan Pamuk's Nobel Prize in Literature being received in Turkey, in your circles?
Well, in my circle, in my particular circle, it's been received with great joy, because we all feel that Orhan Pamuk is a fine novelist, and he has deserved this prize, as well as all the other prizes that he has gotten before this one. But there are, of course, other reactions. There is, there's a half-hearted congratulatory reaction from the more traditional writers who are proud that a prize is awarded to a Turkish writer, but they seem to embrace more the prize than the author. And then, of course, there's the third kind of response, which is from the ultra-nationalists of all grade or nationalists of extreme gradations. And unfortunately, that response is not as feeble as I thought it would be. They condemn both the writer and the prize. They even see this as a conspiracy of the West to humiliate the Turks by, awarding someone who is a dissenter.
Ultranationalists saying that...
What they utter is a string of abuses that I don't care to repeat here. Basically, there are these three responses.
And what about, we understand that, they've said this belittles our national values, the ultranationalist, but the more traditionalist response, why the lukewarm response there? What is it about Orhan Pamuk's work that leads to less than enthusiasm?
The more traditionalist response is inspired by, kind of envy on the one hand, from other writers who think that there were other people who have deserved it and didn't get it. And there indeed were, of course, other people who deserved it and didn't get it. Also, there is something about Orhan Pamuk that makes them think he is perhaps a bit too Western, too Westernized to be considered properly rooted in the tradition.
Mm. We hear that full range, Hale Parla, and we're grateful to you for bringing it to us directly from Istanbul, there at Bilgi University. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let me take a call from John in Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Two comments quickly. The first one is for Maureen. And I wanted to say that I recommend snow frequently to friends. And one of the things that I always say when I recommend it is because the translator has done a really fabulous job of creating the appropriate texture.
Hats off to Maureen and Orhan, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, the translators' names are often in small print, names that we don't remember. So I just wanted to congratulate you on
She's
that.
She's right here
Thank
right
you very
now.
Much. Thank you very
but
much.
The other thing that struck me about the book is that beyond any particular cultural theme, Snow has this theme of using noble intentions and noble pretenses to cover up less than noble motives. And one example of that is when Ka, the main character, creates a meeting of sort of a peacemaking meeting or a collaboration meeting as a pretense to get his girlfriend's father out of the house so that he can have some time with her.
Mm-hmm. This in a book where the sort of central conflict is around whether or not young girls should wear headscarves in school. Many, many layers in Orhan Pamuk. John, thanks for your call. Merle's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Merle. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to comment that I live in Istanbul, Turkey, and as we interact with our neighbors in an all-Turkish neighborhood, kind of upper-middle-class, educated people, there was a lot of negative feeling about Orhan Pamuk and that the West, as one of your previous commentators said, really see the West as using this to somehow put pressure on Turkey to change as a conspiracy to move Turkey toward the West. And our neighbors would say, yeah, that's that. They would not see him as a great writer or someone they should honor since he's been on trial.
And how would you describe your neighbors? We heard Hale Parla's enthusiasm. We heard her say traditionalist, not so crazy, ultranationalist, bitterly critical. Where do your neighbors fall in that?
Well, I would say they're pretty moderate, typical middle-class Turks who are living like we live here in the States, concerned about their families and so on, but they feel they're not nationalists, and yet there's such a strong national pride within it that they see that they're not sure about this.
Merle, calling from Iowa City, living in Istanbul, thanks for calling. Stephen Kinzer, how do you see it? Can we look at Orhan Pamuk and say, the man who just told us, take it easy, these cultures can live together, he gives us hope, or is he the outlier who's sort of the exception that proves that we've got a problem at the center?
I think it's true that the reader base for Orhan Pamuk's novels is broader and more enthusiastic in many countries outside of Turkey than it is in Turkey itself. I think there are several reasons for this. One is stylistic. The traditional Turkish novel reading public is used to stories that are linear, that are plot and character driven. This is not the style of Orhan Pamuk. He's much more circular and much more demanding, and it's a style with which the large Turkish readership is not yet familiar and comfortable. Secondly, of course, is the substance of who Orhan Pamuk is and what he symbolizes. There are certainly people in Turkey who feel that he's gone too far towards the West, which is quite odd in one sense, because he is actually one of the most vivid and honest portrayers of Islam and even fanatic Islamic beliefs, much more understanding in many ways of the Islamic mentality than many other so-called pure Turkish novelists. And then I think there could be a third reason why Orhan Pamuk's novels are more popular in places like the United States than they are in Turkey itself, and that has to do with what your previous caller said. They've been beautifully translated. Some people who are intimately familiar with the Turkish language have told me that they have trouble with his style in Turkish. I've never heard anybody who has read the English translation say they had any trouble with his style.
Maureen, that goes right to you.
Well, thank you, Stephen, but I love the style in Turkish as well. I think he has the sentences are complicated, but he has a real, really mesmerizing storyteller's voice. There was something else I wanted to say. I did go to Orhan's trial last December, and a few days before, we, you know, to cheer ourselves up, we went for a walk in the old city, following the path of one of the walks in the Black Book.
In Istanbul, yeah.
Yeah, and people were coming up to him and giving him support. You know, little people, ordinary people who don't read, and they were saying, they tried to knock you down, and you stood standing.
It's great to hear. You know, it's a day of celebration. Maureen Freely, the last word goes to you. What do you hope the world takes away from witnessing this honor for Orhan Pamuk?
I hope that more people will go to his wonderful books and read them and understand the humanity of this world. And I also hope that Turkey will very, very slowly come to realize that it must begin to honor the, you know, the writer who's put them back on the world map.
Maureen Freely, translator of Orhan Pamuk's work, including Snow, The Black Book, Istanbul, Memories, and the City, joining us from the University of Warwick in England. Maureen Freely, thank you very much for being with us on this day.
It's a real pleasure.
And Stephen Kinzer, former New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul, author of Crescent and Star. Steve, great to have you with us. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
It was fun to be at the party.
A great party indeed. In a moment, the Nobel Peace Prize goes to a man who brought banking to the world's poor. This is On Point. The Nobel Peace Prize was awarded today to 65-year-old Bangladeshi economist Mohammed Yunus and his Grameen Bank for their work in microloans to the poor. In the 1970s, Yunus began distributing tiny loans to the poor, especially women, to spawn their own small businesses. The practice, known as microlending, has helped address bottom-rung poverty in Bangladesh and has spread to developing countries around the world. Joining me to look at this from Oslo, Norway, is Bjørn Hansen. He's foreign affairs commentator for the Norwegian Broadcasting Corporation. Bjørn Hansen, thank you for being with us. Why do you think Mr. Yunus has drawn this honor, this attention from the Nobel Prize Committee?
I think he has drawn the attention because, he's been on the list for a long time. He's been proposed for a long time, many years. The committee is seeking new ways to look at the problem of conflicts and especially human rights and poverty in the world. And this is an outstanding case of one man and one bank who has been helping millions of people out of poverty and perhaps out of civil conflict.
What was the word before the announcement today of the Peace Prize, the biggest in a way of all the Nobel Prizes? Who else was considered to be in the running?
Well, I talked to the chairman of the committee just after the announcement today, and he said to me that he mentioned two names. One was Martti Ahtisaari, who has been on top of the list of bets about the prize. And the other one was a very surprising name, in fact, the former Australian foreign minister, Gareth Evans, who is leader of an organization called the Crisis Group. It's a research group, and they are researching crises around the world. It's a rather big organization, more than 100 people. I think these two have been on the short list too, but it's hard to say because they never publish anything.
But it didn't go there. It went to Muhammad Yunus and his Grameen Bank. Bjørn Hansen, thanks very much for the framework there. Thank you for joining us from Oslo.
It's a pleasure.
I'd like to bring in another voice here to talk about the whole concept of microfinancing. Jonathan Murdoch is a professor of public policy and economics at New York University, NYU. He's co-author of the book, The Economics of Microfinance. He joins me from Princeton. Jonathan Murdoch, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So here's Muhammad Yunus. He's been doing this for a long time. He's even been on the short list or the maybe Nobel Peace Prize winner list for a while. What is this? How does it work exactly? And how big an impact is it making?
This is an exciting day. Yunus has really rethought a number of different ways of approaching poverty. What he's done is create a successful bank, but he's also really helped us rethink ways of approaching foreign aid. And so the impact is both on the 6.5 million customers in Bangladesh who now have financial services and didn't have that kind of financial services before, but also on the 100 million customers around the world who've taken who've been able to take advantage of Yunus's lead and also become customers of this kind of institution.
Can you give us some examples of the kind of loan that would be made? How much, for what, with what outcome?
The typical loan from the Grameen Bank would be a small loan that might have a year's duration that would be paid back in small increments by the week, and that might allow a poor woman in a village in Bangladesh to, for example, buy a cow and fatten it up and then later sell it for a profit, or might allow her to buy some supplies to stock a store, which she could then sell to neighbors or others in the community. With those kinds of loans, often starting at $100 and then gradually getting up to $200, $300, $500, women in Bangladesh have been able to transform their livelihoods, to expand businesses, and ultimately to sort of change their position, not just in their families, but in their communities. And that's really been exciting to a lot of people who see this as not just a great economic innovation, but also a real social transformation.
Or even, as we heard on the news this morning, for women to buy a cell phone and then become a kind of mini phone company, renting it out for people to make calls. Is the Grameen Bank, which Muhammad Yunus shares the Nobel Peace Prize, is it at this point a commercial undertaking, or is it still a kind of an aid project?
The Grameen Bank is an interesting entity. I think by now, although I haven't looked closely at the books, you'd need a professional accountant to do that, that they are making profits. They're taking a lot of money in savings, and they're lending out at interest rates, which are 20% or higher, that enable them to make profits. In addition, as you mentioned, they've got these really interesting other businesses, like the cell phone business, which generate profits and which allow them to expand what they're doing on the social side.
And it's been working for some years now. So what can we conclude? Could this actually spark a bottom-up kind of a rescue of the world's poor, or is this a marginal piece of what needs to be done? Might it be the central thrust one day?
It's a great question, and it's one that gets debated. One of the interesting things about the statement of the Nobel Committee was that they see microfinance as a great tool in alleviating poverty, but certainly not as a panacea. And it was interesting in the context of Muhammad Yunus's speeches, which are often about taking microfinance and using it as a way to eliminate poverty. He often talks about creating museums of poverty, poverty museums, that we'll have to erect when one day microfinance has eliminated poverty from the planet. And so he talks in very kind of inspiring, but also very optimistic terms about the power of microfinance. I think most people, though, see it as an important tool, but not as the answer.
I tell you, just to hear the phrase poverty museums, or one day we might look back on it, that is inspiring in itself.
It's true. He's a great visionary. I saw him give a talk a few years ago that went on for 2 hours. It was almost, you know, Castro-like. But it went on for 2 hours, and he was so inspiring and engaging that I didn't see anybody check their watch. So he's not only been a great innovator, a visionary, a manager also of his bank, but he's also inspired a worldwide movement. And that's really why this prize is so well-deserved.
And today, Mohamed Yunus and his bank, the Grameen Bank, sharing the Nobel Peace Prize. Jonathan Murdoch at NYU looked at microfinance all over the world, Indonesia, China, Bangladesh. Thanks very much for being with us for a few minutes today.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.